Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Fire Cider, a health tonic based on the traditional New England cure-all of raw apple cider vinegar and honey. For more information, visit firecider.com. Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in where?
Bushwick.
Bushwick, Brooklyn. That's Bushwick. Give me the face. Give me the Bushwick face.
I can't anymore.
Ah, it's she's dead inside. Now, let me tell you something about Stas. Once she gets to a certain point, she's just dead inside. You know what I mean? You're no longer even worth disdain. Like, disdain takes energy, people. Does. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Sadly, we are not joined today in the...
Yeah, I don't know where she is. Well, oh, Jack, yeah.
And this, yes, Rebecca,
don't know
our live tweeting guru, is not here.
She quit already.
Wow, strong. Well, it wouldn't be the first time, right? Yeah. Wouldn't be the first time. But we have Liz in the booth today. How you doing, Liz?
I'm great. I'm just going to answer your first few calls here and get the show on the road, man. You got so many fans, so eager.
Here we go. So kind. We have a caller right now? Yeah. So today, Nastassi and I are going to taste the cider that I made. Maybe if we have time, talk about how I made it, how it's a little different from regular cider. I had some other things if we have time to get to it. I have the new Pharos grinder from Orphan Espresso, the coffee grinder, and I can do a little on-air review of that. Spoiler alert, I needed to do some modifications to it to make it exactly kind of the way I wanted to, so we could talk about that later if we have time. But do we have a caller right now?
We do.
All right, caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave, Nastassia, not Jack, unfortunately. This is Antoine from Boca Raton.
Oh, how are you all doing? He will be sad he missed your call.
Today's question is about simple syrups, how to make them shelf stable, and then also I took your orgeat recipe, and unfortunately whenever I mix it with acid it like clumps up, and I didn't know if you had any workaround with that.
Yeah, so the usually when you get clumping on that, and you're using it like in a shaking cocktail, right?
Yeah.
I mean, usually what that means is you have kind of a high amount of nut solids left in, which, by the way, one of my favorite words, nut solids. You like that one, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a good one. That's mm-hmm. That's a Nastassia-approved term, nut solids. But the and there's a couple of workarounds on it. You put the Ticoloid in?
Yes.
You could hit it with a little more. You could hit it with a little more xanthan. I don't think the jacking the Arabic's going to help much. I mean, you could try just upping the level in the overall system, but usually it's the xanthan that you need to up a little bit, but not a lot, right? So there's very little xanthan in Ticoloid 210 or 310. It's mostly Arabic, but I think a little bit more xanthan might help. I mean, maybe upping the entire system might help a little bit, but it's definitely a question of like high nut solids. Trying to think of what we used to solve it just by post blending it, right, Stas?
Yep.
In other words, like when we originally made our when Stas and I were doing like pecan bourbon sours, we started originally with pure pecan oil. Pure pecan oil will not break at all with a Ticoloid. But when we started adding pecan nut solids back, we would start getting clumping. It would unclump if you just went boom, 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 and like hit it for a second, but you can't really do that at a bar. So I would try to up it a little bit and see whether you can get it. I'm trying to think of what else would stabilize it. Let me think on it. If I think of anything else, I'll get back to you. But try that and let me know how it works, because I hate that. The cloudy look, that puffy look on the inside of a drink.
Yeah.
I hate that so much. Don't you hate that?
Yeah, I do.
It's the worst.
Yeah, like you, for instance, like in your recipe, you call for like it's 1.75 ticaloid and then 0.2 grams xanthan. How much more would you recommend, like, I guess, going up?
What was the base? What was the water base?
Just the water. Like, I
mean, how much water for that much? Are you talking percentages?
It's yeah, 660.
What?
660 of water.
Yeah, I mean, look, try doubling the xanthan and see what happens. It's still a very small amount in the finished drink. You just want the pourability of the orgeat to remain high. And, you know, obviously, like, blend the crap out of the orgeat before you do it. How are you getting rid of the solids?
I'm straining them, like, 5 different times.
Yeah, it's kind
like,
of
with everything I can.
Centrifuge is really good at this. But I'm just saying.
Unfortunately, I'm holding out for a good one. I've heard is on the way.
Yeah, we're even though we haven't officially announced what it is yet, we're already kind of taking suggestions on names. So check out this one. I don't really like. Okay, so like the obvious name is Clearzol, right? Right. That's the obvious name, Clearzol. But the problem is that unlike a Searzol, which literally sears all. Like, if it's a foodstuff, it is searable, right, with a Searzol. I mean, this isn't going to clear everything. It's just going to do, like, a lot of the stuff that we need done. So I wouldn't call it, like, it clears all, because I'm a truth in advertising sort of a fellow, even though it does make a certain sort of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I will try to stabilize eventually. I should try to stabilize eventually some just plain strained nut milk orgeat, but it's got to be just upping the xanthan a little more. Try upping the xanthan in the batch you already have and see what happens, and just tweet on back and let me know what happens. Or if anyone else in the Twitter universe there has had experience adding some more stabilization to it, just let us know.
Also, how do you recommend doing, like, stabilizing just other simple syrups that I might make as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Without affecting the flavor.
That depends on, well, okay. So, like, you mean stabilize them?
Like shelf stabilizing,
right? The main problem in simple syrups is kind of yeast and mold formations, right? So you know, it's all a question of what you want to add. Like a little bit of benzoate will kill like most of the yeasty stuff and stop that from happening. But you know, how long do you want them to last?
A few months at least.
But like make them. Like, and what are we talking? Like, how, like, can they take heat? Can you throw them in, like, a vac bag and just, like, poach them at a low temperature to kill the yeast and then keep them in your fridge? Nothing dangerous is going to grow at 50% sugar. Do you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So, like, what I would do is, like, throw them into a bag, like, circ them at a relatively low temperature that's not going to mess with the flavor, but is enough to kill, you know, any kind of yeast kind of stuff, like, you know, mid-50s somewhere, Celsius, and then throw that in the fridge, and then refrigerated, you know, once it's been pasteurized, it should last. You know, I don't think, I mean, someone can get back and tell me I'm wrong, but nothing bad should grow, and no molds will grow after you do that because they're not going to survive that, and no yeasts are going to grow. And I've never been contaminated with any sort of like vile bacteria. It's all been kind of yeasts and molds, and that little bit of heat will do it. Or you could just hit it with something like benzoate, but then you've added benzoate to it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so then, like, you know, some people will say they can taste it, or some people will think that you're an evil human being for doing it. So, they, you know, just, you know, go the other way.
What do you think about adding, like, the tablespoon of vodka around?
Oh, I don't know if that's enough. Have other people had good luck with that?
I haven't tried it out yet. I didn't want to ruin it here.
I mean,
experimenting with it.
I mean, I don't think it's going to ruin it. I just don't know if it's enough. You know what I mean? Like,
gotcha.
So you're looking for hurdles, and so if you figure, I mean, you have to figure out how much of your, I mean, half of the syrup by weight is water, but you got to calculate how much water is in it because the density of a regular simple syrup is roughly 1.23 roughly. And so like a liter of the product will weigh 1.23 kilos, half of which is water. So there's roughly 615 mils of water in every liter of simple syrup.
Okay. Right?
And so then you'll know what your alcohol content is. And so, like, you know, a couple tablespoons and, you know, is not ever going to get you too high up. But the question is a little bit of alcohol enough to kill or to prevent yeast and mold from growing so long as the sugar content is so high? And that I don't know, because I don't know how close you are to the threshold. Now, you could make rich simples, right? And those are even more stable. But mold, as anyone who has stored maple syrup for long periods of time not in the fridge will tell you, mold will grow on the top of maple syrup.
Okay. Solid.
And it makes it disgusting. Also, you ever had moldy maple syrup?
I have.
It's gross.
Maple syrup?
No, moldy maple syrup.
Oh, no, I've never had moldy maple syrup.
It's the worst. You know, as good as maple syrup is, that's how bad moldy maple syrup is. I would say, here's how I think I would rank these kinds of things. Rotten pistachio is the top, right? That's the worst thing in the world, a rotten pistachio. Stas, do you agree?
Gross.
I've never had one of those bad pine nuts that wipes out your palate for a million years. But a rotten pistachio is way up there. Maple, like moldy maple syrup, not that bad, but pretty damn bad, especially considering how good you think it's going to be. Liz, what's your least favorite bad thing?
I would have to go with when you get like the bad pistachio.
Yeah.
That's like disgusting. It ruins your whole day.
I would agree. And you know what? It's always like you've eaten a lot of pistachios and then you get that one and you were happy. You get in that kind of choo-choo train rhythm of eating pistachio nuts. And then you get that one and you're like, But you know, the thing is that you can kind of look at them and know. So like we used to buy like the canned shelled pistachio nuts, and always our syrups were never like as good as they could be. And so then we like would dump. This is why one of the reasons everyone hates me is I would say, okay, from now on, you're dumping every pistachio nut onto a sheet tray, and you're putting eyeballs on every last pistachio nut because you can look at them. They look, first of all, the color's not right. A lot of them get a little yellow and oxidized and whatever. They're still okay, but it's the wrinkly ones. When you're shelling them yourself and you look down, you see that wrinkly pistachio nut. Just don't eat it. Don't eat that nut. You know what I'm saying?
I just want to blindly shovel them in my mouth, though. So
I appreciate that. So what you need to do, Liz, is you need to become rich enough that you can have someone who pre-sifts your pistachios for you, and then you can blindly shovel them into your. Do you feel the compulsion to break them open, or can you just have shelled pistachio nuts and you're okay?
I think I'm okay with the shell.
You don't mind having someone pre-shell them for you?
Oh, no, I wouldn't mind that either. I mean, it's life goals right here.
Right. I mean, for me, there's something about, like, sitting there and, like, cracking open the things that I kind of enjoy. I know Nastassi never watches stuff. You ever watch James Bond movies?
Sure, yeah.
So there was Topol, the guy who was in one of the Fiddler on the Roof movie. Topol was one of the good guys in one of the James Bond movies where they had to climb up some monastery, I think, in Greece. And he had the habit of being able to throw pistachio nuts into his – here's a life goal for you. He could throw a pistachio nut in the shell in his mouth, eat the pistachio, and spit the shells out. That, my friends, skill.
Wow.
Skill.
Movie factor.
I
call movie factor.
Yeah. Anyway, so we should all work on
that. Thank you very much.
All right.
I wanted to just let you know that Jeremiah Bullfrog sends his regards, and he would love to get you down here.
Oh, my God. He was in New York, but the museum exhibit wasn't open yet, so he sent me a picture of the outside. I didn't get to talk to him, so hopefully he got to go inside. Hopefully the machines were running this. By the way, museum opens tomorrow, people. Museum of Food and Drink, 62 Bayard in Brooklyn. Jeremiah Bullfrog, excellent man, as we all know. Museum opens in Brooklyn tomorrow, complete with, and now I'm allowed to tell you about everything in it. Check this out. We have it's about the flavor industry. We've talked about this a million times, right? The birth of the flavor industry.
Yes.
We have these machines called like smell synths that let you play, like, it's like an arcade game where you mix smells in an arcade game fashion, like an early arcade game. Like, I don't know, like Space Invaders. You like Space Invaders?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good game, Space Invaders. But you're not shooting anything. It's not a first-person shooter. But it literally runs off of arcade buttons, and it's got LEDs. No noises. It's going to be fun. Anyway. All right.
So Jack Davis in the chat room likes Spindax as a name for the centrifuge.
Spindax? But what about Booker? Booker will be so upset.
I don't think. Do you think he'll care?
Do I think Booker will care? I mean, like, I think maybe later in life he'll care. Right now he obviously doesn't care.
Maybe.
All right. Okay, okay, let me get into some questions. Unless we have a caller, I'm going to get into some questions. This from Brian in Seattle. Hi, Dave, Nastassia, Jack, and Rebecca. Well, Jack and Rebecca
Rebecca's
don't
here.
Like it. Oh, Rebecca is here?
Yes.
Oh, nice. All right. And Liz. We'll add Liz to the list here. I remember reading in Liquid Intelligence that Dave uses 200-proof alcohol for some cocktail ingredients, like a Justino's, but that it wasn't generally – wait, that's what Stas thought the good name was, right?
I think it is the Justino 54.
Yeah, because 54 Eldritch was our old lab, and a Justino is like a Justino. We should at least just informally refer to
that. That was actually where I like woke up in the morning, and I was like, Justino 54. Justino 54. Because I sent it to you at like 8 a.m.
Or the Justino 54,000?
Yeah, I like that.
Anyway, but I think Justino is
54,000 RPM.
Because it, but it's not. But we could. Yeah, I'll just call up China and be like, "Yo, China, I know that we said it was going to run in more like, you know, like 5,000 RPM, but how about 5,400?" They're like, "But look, no. It's a marketing thing. Believe me. I think it's good, right? Anyway, Justino, yeah, because like Justino like 4958 is not such a good number.
No,
right?
5,400. Yeah,
5,400.
I like that.
Now we'll call after we get off the air. We'll call China.
Okay.
Then we'll wake them up from sleep. They'll be, "What's wrong?" They'll be like, "Nothing. We need it to go 5,400 RPM." We'll tell you later. Okay. Like Justino's, but that it wasn't generally available to the public. In looking for some, I stumbled across a California product called Clean Extract, K-L-E-E-N Extract. And they're at cleanextract.com, apparently, which purports to be 200-proof food-grade ethyl alcohol and available for shipping to the public in many states. It seems like the product is geared towards making tinctures of various herbs. What do you think about the word tincture, Stas?
Hmm.
I think it's kind of a gross word.
Mm-hmm.
Tincture.
Tincture.
Tincture. Not as bad as spula.
Gross.
Spula. Tinctures of various herbs. Herbs in quotes. By that we mean marijuana. When someone says herb in quotes, it means pot. Did you know that?
I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know these things. So it comes in large sizes, like 1 gallon plus. Would there be any problem using it in cocktails? And if not, any interesting doors it opens up that 190-proof Everclear does not? I've heard that pure alcohol is hygroscopic, which it is. It absorbs water out of the air. Would this just extract water from the air until it hits 190, making it no better than Everclear? Love the show. Keep up the awesome work. Brian from Seattle. Look, once you're up at 190 versus 200, the proof isn't really making that much of a difference anymore. That little bit of water isn't making a lot of difference in terms of the flavors you're getting. The reason I hate Everclear, and no offense to the manufacturers of the product Everclear, it sucks. It's just a rancid, awful, poorly made product that no matter how – I mean, we've all been to college. You've had Everclear dumped into Kool-Aid, right, Stas?
Mm-mm. I didn't go to those parties.
What about you, Liz and Rebecca? Did you have Everclear in Kool-Aid situations?
I went to the University of Missouri, and we held Everclear in high regard, so yes.
Yeah, okay, so let me ask you this. Even when it's diluted in large amounts of a grape Kool-Aid, you can still smell the Everclear
from miles away.
Yeah, why? Because Everclear is a poorly made product.
It's like Purell.
Purell. That's basically what Purell. Purell is like poorly made. Actually, like poisonous. They denatured Purell, I think. Anywho, so I think it's just poorly made. I think that's the issue. So that's my main gripe with it, not the proof. So if this clean extract is good to go, it's good to go. But you do not require – in fact, at the bar now, we use something called Technical Reserve that's made right here in Brooklyn. It's 190, and that's what we use for everything just because, you know, it's pretty clean. You want clean aroma. You could also, like, if you get crappy Everclear, you could put it through 18 million runs of a Brita to try and strip out all the nasties. Remember when we used to be so cheap that we would buy, like, you know, Smirnoff and Pop-Off vodka, and we would just sit there putting it through Brita time and time again, Brita after Brita after Brita, until the stank went away, so that we used it when we were rotovapping at the school.
Mm-hmm.
Back when we were allowed to rotovap alcohol. Well, not allowed. I mean, the government said it was illegal, but no one was stopping me from
teaching
people distillation. Yes. Anyways, okay. Hey, you guys want to taste? You guys in the booth want to taste cider? We need some glasses for us.
Ooh, yes.
Let's taste some of the cider that I made from my very own tree. We need glasses for us. Anyway, let me see what we got here. Truffles got an interesting question in from Arnie Olson. I found a couple of small truffles in the forest near my home in Bergen, Norway. I'm sure Bergen, Norway, no offense to New Jersey, but it's the county where I used to live is Bergen County. And I don't, you know.
Probably looks the same, right?
It's probably just the same. Probably just as nice. No. No, no offense to Bergen. Hey, look, you know what we are, Bergen? We're the gateway to New York. We got the George Washington Bridge. That's what we got there in Bergen. Anyway, Bergen's a fine county. No offense to us. You know what their newspaper is? The Bergen Record. The Bergen Record. Okay, not Norway. Okay, their Elaphomyces granulatus, known as deer balls. Heart's balls, heart meaning deer, not heart mean heart like H-A-R-T, not heart like, you know, corazon. Mm-hmm. Heart's truffles or lycopodon nuts. That's from Wikipedia. And not regarded as particularly high quality. Still, I would like to make the most of them. And my question is, would rapid infusion work to make a truffle oil? I'm not very fond of truffle oil, but I can't think of any better way to use them. And they're not super aromatic, and the texture isn't great either. Best, Arnie Olson. Now, listen, I tried to look these suckers up, and by all accounts, everyone's like, you know, maybe they're edible, barely. Maybe they're poisonous, mildly. So, like, nobody seems to know. But I'm reminded back of when Paul Adams, our friend from Popular Science, came up to Connecticut and found some bitter boleet, which doesn't taste that good. And he made boleet butter, remember? And he brought it into the radio program, and it was good. So I would try, rather than doing oil, which, you know, I would maybe do a deer ball butter, right? Deer ball butter. By the way, the lycopodon is a puffball, and the Wikipedia, if you look that up, actually says that word comes literally from the, I think, Latin meaning wolf farts. Wolf farts. Have you ever eaten puffballs?
No.
You can eat puffballs, you know. You just have to make sure, you have to cut through them and make sure that they're not an immature form of another mushroom that could kill you. But puffballs themselves, they're okay. They're not the greatest thing. Oh, but you know what? I went to a Polish store yesterday, and I need to talk to Lukasz, you know, friend of the show, that the Poles have forgotten more about mushrooms than we're ever going to know. So many different pickled mushroom varieties. Huh. You know how, like, we just have, like, pickled, like, you know, like those, like the regular pickled mushrooms, and you're like, that, this is like, I didn't bring them with me because they need to be chilled, but, like, you're going to like this one, slippery jack mushrooms, honey mushrooms.
Yeah,
when Jack comes, well, I'm glad I didn't bring it because Jack's not here to have slippery jack mushrooms, but I was going to give him some. Anyway, I need to learn more about Polish mushrooms. Okay, on the truffle oil thing, look, the whole point, apparently, and I was doing some research, there is a book, not for Europe, but for America, called, that I didn't get a chance to order because I just saw these questions last night, but it's actually on the list now of things I want to order, called Field Guide to Truffles of North America, and this truffle is included in it because it comes from North America. And the reason the truffles, apparently, and this is interesting to me, have aroma is because they want you to, if by you mean small mammals, find you, dig you up, eat you, and crap out the spores. So that's why they have aroma. So perhaps one of the problems with the particular truffle that you have, the deer ball, is maybe it's not at its best, because at its best it should have an aroma, but they have a longer persistence than like tuber melanosporum or things like this, and so they're going to remain findable in the ground well past or before the point when they actually have their aroma. So if they don't have much aroma, I don't think they're going to have much of anything but try making a butter. Is that a good answer?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't tell. You want to go to commercial break?
Yeah, and then we'll try.
Let's go to commercial break, and as we come back from commercial break, we'll try some cider on cooking issues.
Today's program was brought to you by Fire Cider. Did your grandmother ever tell you to drink raw apple cider vinegar? It's good advice and more common than you may think. For generations of New Englanders, a tot of vinegar was a morning ritual. Taken daily, a tablespoon of unfiltered apple cider vinegar can help support immune function and digestive functions. To the base of certified organic apple cider vinegar, Fire Cider added whole, raw, certified organic oranges, lemons, onions, ginger, horseradish, habanero pepper, garlic, and turmeric. They let this mixture steep for 6 weeks at room temperature to preserve the living vinegar culture and delicate flavors of the ingredients. Lastly, they blend a generous helping of raw wildflower honey into the mix. The result is potent but balanced, offering layers of sweet, tart, and spice. Fire Cider tastes great on its own or as an addition to tea, juice, or salad. Fire Cider ships direct from their online store and is available at over 500 locations nationwide. Use their store locator to find one near you and ask for a free sample. For more information, visit firesider.com.
Firesider, huh?
I don't know.
Do we have any of that stuff in-house? We could try. Liz, do we actually own that product?
The silence means no.
Silence means no. Well, we'll get it in. We'll try it. We'll talk about it. But while we're on cider, so what we have here is, look, in the back of this house that I acquired in Connecticut, there is a standard size, what looks to be similar to a Golden Delicious, but it's not. It doesn't taste exactly like Golden Delicious, but it's super high. So you can't get the apples out of it very easily. But I got one of those 12-foot pool poles with a little picker on the end of it and got enough off to make some 8 gallons of cider. And I wanted to make a very kind of particular kind of cider. So here's what I did that's different from normal. First of all, I don't have a cider press, so I juiced it all in a Champion juicer. Yes, because I'm that much of a masochist and an idiot. So I juiced it all in a Masochain juicer. Also, I didn't want to have like a typical kind of oxidized cider taste, so I hit the cider with ascorbic. I hit the juice with ascorbic acid as soon as it was juiced. I did not add pectinase to the enzyme because SPL to it before fermentation, because I knew that apples like this typically lose a lot of their character when they're spun out. They're not like a high flavor apple like an Ashmead's kernel where the juice is delicious even after all the solids are out of it. So I wanted to ferment it on its solids. So I doped it with yeast. I added a small amount of sugar because they were fairly low Brix, and put them in 5-gallon buckets and did a primary fermentation for a couple of weeks at them at relatively cool temperatures because the house is relatively cool. And then here is where I differed. After the primary, I added SPL and swirled them around to drop the stuff out. Then I put the entire batch through the Justino
5400
to get rid of like a lot of the flock and yeast sediment in it that was left, and got a pre-cleared thing. But here is another trick I used, people, that I think is I don't know whether anyone else does this, but because I was introducing that oxygen there, I didn't want a high vinegar note on it. I wanted the acidity to stay what it was, and I didn't want it to oxidize. So what I did is I immediately semi-carbonated it while it was warm. I didn't want to highly carbonate it, but I semi-carbonated it in 2-liter bottles using a carbonation rig. You could do it in a keg if you had one. Poured them semi-carbonated into bottles that I had added the dosage to, capped them, and then let them bottle condition for a couple of weeks. So here we have it.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers, folks in the booth. Rebecca, Liz.
We like.
It's good, right?
Yep.
It's good.
Yeah. Yeah, very tasty for all you listeners out there. All my chat room friends.
Yeah, so this is like, it's still very, very tart because it's a fairly high acid. I was able to literally beat another batch of apples off the tree that are lower in acid. So I'm going to try to make kind of a less tart one. But the idea here is like for this kind of cider, a minimal amount of oxidation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah.
And the answer, my friends, is ascorbic acid and a little pre-carbonation before the bottle conditioning. I wish I had some cheddar cheese.
That'd be good.
Wouldn't that be good?
Mm-hmm.
Some really super sharp cheddar cheese.
Mm-hmm. And some crackers.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know what? We're simple people, Anastasia and I. Like, good. I don't even need, like, hyper-expensive. I just need nice, sharp. Like,
mm-hmm.
Like would I if someone, like, parachuted in here with, a wheel of Montgomery's, cheddar from Neil's Yard, like, would we turn them down? No. We would kill them and steal the cheese. Need it. But, you know, I don't even need necessarily that high quality.
Mm-mm.
And on that note, we have another caller.
Mm. Oh, yeah, caller? Are they going to talk about killing people? Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. This is Colin down in D.C.
How you doing?
I'm just calling in because you got a guy calling, this Alex G. fellow calling in last week asking about some sweet potato caramel syrup.
Right.
And it was me that called in about that about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago.
All right. So what happened? Let us know what happened.
He must have been remembering back to. So just figured I could call in and give him and everyone else a, like, just real fast update on that stuff.
Do it.
The syrup, right, that I've been able to reproduce pretty successfully. The biggest key really is start with a really high Brix sweet potato. If you can get Heart of Gold, those are your best option. Otherwise, just try whatever you can get. locally and just experiment and see what works. But you get best yields out of Heart of Gold because they're high bricks, easy to work with.
I cannot believe you just put that song in my head. I'm so angry that that song's in my head.
Heart of Gold.
It's like it's never going to leave now. It's going to be there like
for... Oh, man. But, I mean, I had the benefit. There's a, just some retired guy, retired professor in Maryland who's got a, you know, 1 acre, 2 acre sweet potato farm, and he put like 14 tons of potatoes in. So I got them there. I don't know where anyone else will get them, but experiment beyond that, and you'll still get a good product. But
we'll just give the procedure really quickly. Just give the procedure.
Yeah, so procedure is juice them out in a, you know, cube them up, juice them in champion juicer. Kind of, you're going to end up with a kind of starchy juice. Add some pectinex to that and some amylase. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
Which amylase do you use? Regular beer house amylase?
I just get the whatever they get at brew shops.
Okay.
And just use a bunch of it. And it helps it out. Circ that out at maybe 65 or 70 C for a day. And you'll see that you'll get a kind of clear liquid on the top of, and a lot of the starch will settle out at the bottom. And a real key here is, decant that clear liquid, reduce it down into a caramel syrup or just a like actual candy caramel as you would normally. The key here is like not getting any starch in. Cause if you get starch in, it just sort of turns more into like a pudding, which is also awesome, but not what you're going for if you're trying for the caramel. I think that's about it. If anyone else, I guess, has questions, they can follow them up and you could tweet it out or whatever, but I just thought I'd take the opportunity to clear that up.
Yeah, are you a part of our chat room? You should, because people might ask you questions right now. If you were to log into the chat room, people might ask you questions like right now.
Yeah, I'm on it.
There you
go. They can ask questions. I'm out and about for like another 20 minutes, but I'll be back if that stays live.
I don't know, Liz. Does it stay live?
Yeah, it's always live.
Uh-huh.
It's however lively right. You make it.
Well, do it. I'm on it. And do it. Cool. I'll sign off, and yeah.
Wait, Liz, are you saying it's like Tinkerbell, and you just have to keep believing in it, and it stays alive?
Yeah, I mean, minus the whole dust thing, but dust.
We don't have dust?
Pixie dust? If only Jack were here, he would know.
Man, we're just like, you know, like, we get close, and we don't quite make it there. I could buy the pixie dust. It's available on Amazon Prime, but no, I'm not going to buy it. Right? We just get so close.
Hey, can I give a shout out to a listener?
Yeah.
Anthony Scardino. I made his life.
What was that?
He's missing a clamp screw.
Oh, and you sent the clamp screw to
him?
Well,
no, I just responded to his email.
Oh, nice. Well, that's quite nice. By the way, I loved when you insulted one of...
I loved that tweet. I tweeted at him.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so he tweeted back his Christmas list to us, the picture of it. And the fifth thing on the Christmas list was get insulted by the co-host of his favorite podcast. And he's like, check number five off. That was perhaps the greatest tweet that I have ever received in my whole life.
Yeah.
I was on the floor. My wife was on the floor. By the way, Stas and Jack are going to try to get my wife into the into the program.
Yes.
I don't know, like, for any of you out there that want to – I don't know why you would want to ask my wife
a
question.
Maybe it could be a Christmas special.
Yeah? I don't know. Anyway. Okay, question in. Would Dave use equilibrium brining chicken fingers? In other words, brining them, I presume, from Joan, I presume that what's meant here is brining the chicken fingers until they are in equilibrium with the brine around them. I have never done that. That would take, I think, quite a while. And then the question is there a refractometer that I would recommend? I'm enjoying the show. Best regards. I don't know. I've never done it that way. Like, I mean, definitely that's the way when you're pickling, when you're doing like brine soak on meats over a long period of time, you know, you definitely you make your brine based on the total weight of brine and meat, and then you check it with you can check it either with you know, one of the density based things like you know, the floating guys, or you can get a refractometer. I don't know, because I've never measured salinity with a refractometer. I don't know how accurate they are over the range of interest for meats, because it's not going to be high. Remember, you're going probably fairly, if you're going to brine to an equilibrium point, you're down low, like, you know, 3% or less, 2 to 3% in that range. So it's going to be relatively tiny amounts, and so I don't know whether – I don't know how accurate a refractometer – a regular refractometer is going to be for salinity at those levels. But I can look into it. I didn't get a chance to look into it, but I can look into it. But, I, you know, in general, what I do is I'm brining for a couple of hours. I don't do – on chicken fingers, they brine relatively quickly, and I don't really do an equilibrium thing. You think that's okay?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Randy writes in. What? Someone when you
guys we do have a caller, if you're interested. All
right. I'm totally interested. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
All right.
This is Chris from the Green Zone in D.C.
How you doing?
Good, good, good. So I can't wait for the Justino 5400, because it directly relates to my question.
Nice.
I called back a while ago about keeping, you know, mint from turning green and also clarifying and filters versus whatever else.
Sure.
I made another batch of my herbal liqueur, and I did it two ways. I did a different thing for the fresh and for the dry ingredients. For the fresh, I just put it in an ISI, like fresh mints and other herbs, and it came out bright electric green. It was awesome. It was relatively clear. All the gunk that was in there settled out immediately. I could just rack it off. Fantastic.
Nice.
And then for the dry stuff, so both spices and herbs, I did it in a circulator in a bag. And it came out to be a very dark green. It was a bit cloudy, and I spent a while filtering it in paper towels and coffee filters. Eventually got it pretty clear, dark green. I figured I'd mix the two. Mixed them together, got the same, you know, halfway point in the green colors. And then since I'm sort of making my own version of chartreuse, which I've heard is sweetened with honey, I made a honey syrup and slowly added it in. It instantly went cloudy and disgusting brown, and I had thought that maybe it had louched or something, the way like an absinthe or an ouzo would.
Right.
But then I left it overnight, and all the stuff that was still making it slightly green had settled on the bottom, and what I got was just a pure brown, clear liquid on top. So in these green infusions and liqueurs and stuff, is the chlorophyll dissolved in the alcohol, or is it just really tiny little particles floating around?
Well, chartreuse is colored with purified chlorophyll from spinach.
Sure.
After it's made, because they're doing a distillation,
right?
Then an age down, and then they're just doping it back you know, it depends on whether you're talking green or yellow, right? Yellow is obviously higher in honey. Did you try doping it with regular sugar? I mean, I wonder what was going on.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I did it with sugar the last batch I made, and it still ended up being really brown.
But it went from being green and stable. It went from being green and stable to brown instantly. But what was the original proof before you added the syrup?
Oh, I mean, it was Everclear, so it was close to 190.
Oh. So it really,
yeah,
huh. So you were adding a good amount of liquid to it, much more. In other words, like, so it's not like you were dealing with something that was relatively low in proof, like 50%, and then adding.
I had almost a liter, or a bit more, actually more than a liter, of the Everclear strength stuff, and then I added almost a liter of honey syrup.
So there's something in there that is oxidizable that, I mean, it wouldn't be enzymatic, because like most of like polyphenol oxidase enzymes are going to be inactivated at that super high proof. Like when I say inactivated, destroyed.
Here's the other thing. The stuff that settled out eventually was actually green.
Huh.
Yeah.
Huh.
And so now I've got a layer of green sludge, and I've got a layer of brown, clear liquid.
Okay, so the brown is probably what color it always probably had that brown in it, and it was just overwhelmed by the green. I'm pretty sure that's what's going on there. So then the question is, why did it suddenly flock? Have you tried doing the reverse? Have you tried adding a small amount of the green to a large amount of water just to see whether or not it stays or whether it flocks together. Like, you might, as you go through this small stage where it's still relatively high proof, but now there's some water, like, all the stuff might instantly aggregate. You know what I mean?
Right, right. No, I haven't tried it like that.
I would try it and see what happens. Hmm. Does the brown stuff taste delicious, or does it not taste the same either?
No, it's pretty good. it just doesn't look very attractive.
Have you tried, especially with the name Green Zone, have you added any to water as though it was a bitters before you added any sweetener to it?
Did I add what to water?
Have you ever used it like as a bitters, just adding a little bit to water before it?
Oh, no, I haven't tried that.
I'd be interested to see what happens, whether it stays clear, whether it flocks together. And someone else on the chat room maybe has some ideas on this. But yeah, this is it's some sort of weird thing that's happening as you're adding water to the system. So I would try going in the other direction and see whether or not you can prevent it from happening. But something is going from it could either be going from soluble to not, or it could be going from stable to all of a sudden flocking. It sounds like the stuff's flocking together. Most stuff that louches.
I thought it was a louche, kind of like absinthe or something, but I don't think it would settle out so quickly.
Well, yeah, louche stuff tends to not settle. It tends to float to the top. You know what I mean? So, like, if you were to like ouzo something out, louche it, and then let it sit for a week, you'll get the stuff usually on top, not on bottom.
Hmm.
So you're getting something that's heavier than alcohol that's settling out.
I filtered it through like layer after layer of coffee filters. So I'm really surprised there's that much solid stuff to settle out.
Well, the other thing, you know, is you could have like solids in there that then they could be charged. It could be like a charged particle that then attaches to the color and then spins it out. So, you know, you never, it's hard to say, but I would try to do the reverse experiment and see whether you can stop it from happening.
Cool. All right. Well, in the meantime, cannot wait for the centrifuge.
Okay, and also in the meantime, make you some spinach juice and do it the way the monks do it.
How do I do that? Just blend up some spinach and dehydrate it?
No, it's been a long time since I've done it. Like, you cook it, you got to get the initial stuff out, then you blend it, and then you squeeze it, and you get the chlorophyll juice, and then that stuff's pretty stable. I have to go look at the protocol for it.
Doesn't taste like spinach?
No, not when you're done with it. You want to get just the clear stuff out. I made some delicious parsley oil in the Justino 54, by the way, and I want to make a drink that it has Ticaloid stabilized parsley oil in it. Wouldn't that be good?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff stays a green for a long time because there's no water in it. It's all oil.
Right.
Anyway, try some of this stuff out and let me know what happens.
Cool. In the chat room, they want to know what you think about that bacon thing from World Health Organization.
Well, tell me about it. I
don't know what it is. Do you know, Rebecca?
They said it's a number one carcinogen now.
Number one? Bacon is more carcinogenic than cigarettes?
No. Okay, it's in the same level category. That's what they're saying.
I mean, based on what data?
I could read you stuff if you want, but I don't have anything.
I will read it. I will read the data, but in general, like, I am loath to believe any of that kind of. It's just like,
because
why? Because if you look at it, like, someone will do a study with a bunch of kind of related risks, and they'll add a bunch of stuff together that has no meaning. Like, I guarantee you that there is not some giant cohort study where the only difference between group A and group B is bacon. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like, you know, half of the people on the bacon side are dropping like flies, right? I mean, it's just, I guarantee that that's not the case. I will look at the data, but I would be willing to bet a chunk of money that if I did look into it, I would come back and say that this is some horse hockey.
Horse hockey. Okay.
Now all the vegans and vegetarians are like, "Grr. We told you, we were right."
Now look, you know, whatever. You know what? And like they say, sassafras will kill you too. You're not allowed. Hey, vegans and vegetarians, you should be able to have real, honest to God, saffron root beer, and you can't because someone told you that it's going to cause cancer. And you know what? I don't know. I think the data is just bad. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at the bacon data, so I have no idea. I have no knowledge, but anyway. So let me rip through this real quick before I get ripped off the air. This is from Randy. I'm making a boneless leg of lamb this weekend and wondered if this is a good way to do it. Cook it low temp for 55 degrees C for 10 hours, then throw it in a 500 degree oven until it hits a final temperature of 60 degrees C. I want to do it this way because I'm worried that if I were to sous vide at the final temperature, the time it would take to properly brown it will overcook it. Thanks, Randy. Do this instead. Cook it at medium rare, like 57 or something like this, and do it for a long time to tenderize it, you know, as long as you have. Then somewhere between 3 and 4 hours before you have to serve it, pull it out of the bath, right? 4 hours before you serve it, pull it out of the bath. Open it up, let the surface dry off, cool it down in the open air for several hours, right? And then, like, as it starts cooling down, throw it into your a billion degree oven, and then you can brown it, and it will have cooled enough that it won't overcook, but you'll also still be good on the inside. And I think that's a better way to go. That's how I typically do that kind of stuff. You can, in fact, let it cool all the way down and then just roast it in super high heat oven and be good. Or you can chill it in water and do it, but that's what I would do. And we have I got to read this, or Ken's going to rip my head off, right? Because we're about to be ripped off the air.
Yes.
There's something else we needed to talk about today. What was it? Oh, the Pharaoh's coffee grinder. I'm not going to get to talk about the Pharaoh's coffee grinder. Is anyone interested in the Pharaoh's coffee grinder?
No.
Stas is not interested. I think there are some people who are interested. It's a very good grinder. Needs some modifications. I have a bunch of STL files that people can print that I'm going to put up on my Twitter account eventually, so that people can modify their Pharaoh's grinders. Okay. Ken writes, I was a little disappointed that an entire show was not devoted to my last email on Parmenides and the epistemology of the sandwich, although I might be a little behind on the podcast. No, we did not go into it for a whole thing. Although the sandwich has been brought up several times. I'm not going to get into it now because I'm just going to go crazy if I do. Undaunted, I write again and ask, could this idea amount to something? Consider that most slow cooker meat recipes require initial searing in a separate vessel because you cannot get the Maillard reaction in a traditional slow cooker, except for the dump and go meals. What are they called? Dump meals? Dump meals.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, terrible idea, dump meals. Similarly, usually reverse issue with sous vide cooking. We have the ability to add various umami elements to cooking, such as anchovies, marmite, mushrooms, soy sauce, fish sauce, and somewhere in the same neighborhood are products like liquid smoke. Don't forget coconut aminos. Do you like coconut aminos, Stas?
I don't know.
Coconut aminos. Do you like the name?
Sure. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
I have this dim memory of Dave getting some press years ago for a burger, not the ketchup soup dumpling thing, but another process, in which he cooked meat separate from the burger to extract some flavor to add later. So with that as a background, could there be manufactured, self-stabilized, freeze-dried Maillard powder or a group of powders with a fairly wide utility? If this is a worthy idea to pursue, then in lieu of a MacArthur Genius Award, I would be happy with a Booker Index, Booker Index Award. Best Kenningberg. Well, what I used to do is I would make like hyper thick, I would like roast the hell out of a lot of meat and then just make like a hyper broth of that and then reduce that down and then circulate meat in that hyper broth. So the entire inside of the hamburger tasted like this kind of hyper broth. So it was a little bit poached, but it was okay because then I was going to pull it out and sear the hell out of it anyway. But because what I noticed when you're doing a lot of low temp cooking is that you never have a lot of those high heat flavors on the meat, even if you do a post sear on it. So that's why, like, you know, if we're dealing with like short ribs and stuff, there's textural reasons as well, but taste reasons why it's never going to taste quite the same. So I would do it. People make meat extracts. Like, the flavor industry makes meat extracts, and we could, and like, conceivably, you could buy like a hyper meat extract that, you know, was all brown and stuff that didn't have 8 boatloads of salt in it, which is the reason why you can't use bouillon cubes and stuff like that. Because a bouillon cube is MSG, which all of you know I have no problem with necessarily, even though I don't really use it. Salt, which unfortunately would add a lot, and then the rest of it is like these flavors. So yeah, doesn't someone make meat, straight meat extract? Any of you guys British? What about Bovril? What's Bovril? No one's British here?
No.
Anyway. I don't know. We'll work on it. Let anyone know. Come into the chat room. Next time I'll talk about Pharaohs and some other stuff. Talk about the first week of the museum exhibit on cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.